This is continuing with Ridbeck over the phone on 15 September 78.
Okay, could you just repeat that last sentence, please?
Well, this, our work in low noise traveling wave tubes led me subsequently to, since the traveling wave tube is based on the principle of interaction between an electron stream, you know, and a slow wave on a spiral structure.
I see.
And that led me to study the interaction between with ionospheric Whistler modes.
Right, right.
In the Kiruna-Arctic ionosphere, between Whistler modes and charged particles that build up the aurora.
That's very interesting. So that your work in the ionosphere was interacting with your work in electronics.
Yes, and that led, you see, to the traveling wave mason.
Right.
Even though I was then not aware of Charlie Townes' work.
I see.
But my idea was to follow its evidence, you see, because I had the difficulty. I built a traveling wave maser for traveling wave tube for 20, which was very high in those days, for 22 gigahertz.
And when, what time are you talking about now?
48.
In 48, wow.
That was because I was then interested in the ammonia line, even though that wasn't detected, you see.
Now, the ammonia line in the laboratory or
yes,
in the sky?
In the laboratory. We had an ammonia line spectrometer.
Right, well, it had been studied in the 30s, crudely.
Yeah, yes, I know that, yes.
Right.
But anyway, what appeared to me during the as a natural development was to, because when working at 23 gigahertz, 22, 23 gigahertz, with that traveling wave tube, you know, it's very difficult to build because the spiral structure is so small.
Yes.
And you get the terrific partition noise because if you don't have a very high quality magnet, many electrons in the beam will strike the helix.
Right,
and
right.
You get partition noise, so that tube was very noisy.
Right.
So then it appeared to me, why not replace the electron stream with say, an ammonia beam or a molecular beam?
I see.
You see, which in principle is the correct thinking.
Right.
A molecular beam amplifier.
Right.
Now then I heard about Charlie Townes' work. And so...
When did you hear about his work?
Must have been 52 or something.
Uh-huh.
53. Don't remember.
But you had not actually begun any construction of such a device.
No, as a matter of fact, I filed a patent application.
Huh.
But for a molecular amplifier. But then, you see, then I became convinced to replace the molecular stream to turn it into a traveling wave maser using chromium doped crystals.
Like yes.
So that's the reason we started building ruby masers already in 1958-59.
And now you're...
We started building masers 20 years ago.
Right. But now, by this time, did you still only have the Wurzburg antennas?
Yes. Now I come back to the next point.
Yes.
That I, you know, when I approached the Science Foundation to get funds to establish the present 24-foot 25.6-meter telescope.
Right.
They said, you can never compete with Jodl Bank. You know,
right, right.
You know, these big antennas. Well, I said, I will be able to compete for Jodl Bank with my traveling wave masers.
Right.
And then, so I said, I would not do any work. As a matter of fact, the first traveling wave maser we built was for the hydrogen line. For the 21-centimeter line. We did our first maser work in that telescope with the 21, on the 21-centimeter.
On the 26-meter telescope.
Yes,
right.
Of course,
that's getting later. Yeah,
yeah, you can't use it to great advantage because the line temperature is so high anyway.
Right, right.
But then I said to the Science Foundation that with my masers, I would be able to compete with Jodl Bank with an 84-foot instrument. And it took me several years to sell that idea.
Which years are these now?
Well, I'm approaching 59 now.
So, and it took you several years starting in 59?
No, it took me several years to get good response in Stockholm to get the money necessary to build a 84-foot telescope.
But when did you finally succeed?
1960.
In 60?
60, 61, winter 60, 69.
Right.
60, 61. And what I had in mind at that time, this is interesting, was to build a copy of the, while I talked to the Verkspo company in Holland, you know. So what I had in mind was a copy of the Dwingelo antenna.
Right.
But then it struck me, you know, that would not be a good antenna for Mesa work. I would have to have a subreflector, you know, and have the helium, liquid helium cooled low noise front end at the apex of the paraboloid.
You wanted to have it much more accessible.
Yes, yeah, well, and to avoid ground noise.
And also, to avoid the background, right.
So, in order to make use of, yeah, and more easily to have an instrument cabin which is more easily accessible.
What about the fact that you probably would want to have a more accurate surface so you could operate at higher frequencies? Was
that came about because my surface is good up to 9 gigahertz.
Right, but I mean, were you reasoning at that time that you could use these masers to better advantage at the higher frequencies?
Yes, but that idea I couldn't sell to the Science Foundation because at the time, no, you see, what I tried to sell was the idea to use a maser.
Right.
My OH traveling wave maser to detect OH.
Right.
And then I knew I could build masers for X-band. But you see, again, people who refereed my application didn't believe that there were any interstellar molecules exist. You see.
Yes, right.
So there was great doubt, you know, at that time in a small country like Sweden, why could you compete with Jodl Bank in the... And people didn't understand really how good, well, many, how good and useful traveling wave masers are, and many great astronomers, as a matter of fact, didn't believe it at all, you know.
No, I can well understand that.
So my idea was to get the surface and a pointing mechanism so I could work up to 9 gigahertz. And this came about by another effort, namely in order to get additional funds, to get the pointing system, gearboxes, and so on that would be good enough up to 9 gigahertz.
Yes.
And a surface and a steerable subreflector. I had to join hands with the Swedish Telegraph Administration.
I see.
And subsequently with the Telegraph Administrations in Norway and Denmark, too. The idea was, namely, that in order to establish the telesatellite ground station in Scandinavia, they had to perform experiments while Telstar was up.
I see.
The other idea being, the other solution would have been to build a micro link down to France.
Right, right.
Make use of the French station. So the Telegraph Administration, they pitched in. They gave me a lot of money to buy better service.
I see.
And I have my back of, you see, it's just very much like the millstone dish.
Yes, right, right.
But it's a heavier back structure.
Right.
You see? So this is structure number two, that are two in the series, and I have a better surface.
Right.
And fairly high accuracy surface, servo control system. That was paid for by the Science Foundation, by the three boards of Telegraph Administration in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, and almost 4 years of experiments, you know, with Telstar and other satellites.
Now, that would be in the early 60s now.
Yes.
What fraction of the time did they have, roughly?
Two-thirds.
Two-thirds. And
so,
what...
you know, I had very... That was a heavy price to pay.
Yes. What fraction of the total cost of the antenna did they...
Well, not two-thirds. I would say one-fourth, one-third.
One-third or so, okay.
But that was my severe condition, and so you see, the present control building, which you have seen, was occupied by the Telegraph Administration, and I had my equipment inside the tower.
I see.
So that's the reason it went on so slowly.
Right.
When we came, my time plan was to, you know, to have the mains going in 63.
Yes.
And then, of course, Weinberg and others detected the OH line.
But now, let me go back a step before we get to the OH. In the late 50s, Were there continued radio astronomical observations at Onsala?
A moment, please. I'll be back.
Yeah, okay. I was just wondering now, were there radio astronomical observations going on in the late 50s at Onsala?
Not much. We still had a 150 megahertz interferometer that did a lot of scintillation work.
Ionospheric scintillation?
Yes.
Yes.
And because we were still control of at that time of the Kiruna part of the Kiruna Observatory operation, so I could see. So when we saw Cathay and other sources through the auroral curtains, we were recording the structure of the auroral curtains at the up north and seeing the scintillation here. So
I see.
Papers are published on scintillation effects, and wave step effects.
But you just did.
But you see, I only had the CH, namely the hydroline radiometry.
Right.
And with the same type of dish in Holland, the Dutch had all done almost everything that could be done at the time.
Right, right. So you just basically could not compete in radio astronomy in the late 50s.
We couldn't, and so the answer was a bigger dish.
Right.
You see, and that, in between, you know, the Science Foundation said, why couldn't we just build the dish on our own? So we built a 12-meter dish. We spent the time on, you know, Hein Batten at NRAO, you know?
Yes, yes.
He's one of my students.
And he helped in building this dish?
He built the 12-meter dish.
And what
which blew to pieces in the 1969 gate.
I see. When was this built now?
Must have been around 59 or something, 58.
And
that would have improved the hydroline recording, you see, because it's a bigger dish.
And was this ever used?
Yes, it was used. It was used, but no, you know, because the receiver was noisy too, you know.
Right.
So a lot of recordings were done, but we didn't obtain anything sort of that really meant a significant improvement over what the Dutch had done.
Right. Right. So everything was hanging on getting the large antenna.
Yeah, of course,
right.
I would say that we did lots of solar noise eclipse work.
Oh, I see, yes. Tell me about that.
When I moved the interferometer to Naples, 1950, there was a solar eclipse in Naples.
In 52, I believe.
52, so I moved both my panoramic ionospheric recorder. I still had version 3.
Yes.
Moved that to Naples, and the 150 megahertz interferometer. But that was an unfortunate experiment in a sense, because it's only partially, I was very doubtful about it, but this was arranged through ERSI.
Yes.
The International Corporation Program or Corporation. But you see, the part of the sun that wasn't eclipsed by the moon.
Yes.
Had sunspots, you see.
Yeah.
As you may recall. So that made it very, very difficult, almost impossible to sort of draw any. We published a report on it, you know. But that was almost a waste of money.
I see. Were there other?
There was another eclipse in 1954. Was it 54?
I think so, in Sweden itself.
Yes, then we did lots of very important ionospheric work on the recombination coefficient of the ionosphere. At the same time, we were recording the sun on 150 megahertz, moving the interferometer up to northern Sweden, not so far from the Norwegian border.
Uh-huh. And did you get some good astronomical results from that?
Yeah, but you know, it's nothing but that you can't do with the better interferometers.
Yeah.
150 megahertz resolution not good enough.
Right.
So that was more or less, again, the type of master science project.
Did you know about the
solar noise? We did solar noise work. Watmos took part in that. I don't recall where he published it on, I guess it was 3 gigahertz or something with the 12-meter dish, as far as I recall, you know, studying limb brightening.
And when was this now?
I don't recall. That was published.
And what was his name?
Hein Vatum. You remember Hein?
Oh, Vatum. Yes, right.
He was one in the group. And we published a paper on the limb. I guess we published a paper on limb brightening.
Okay.
As deduced from the solar eclipse data, you know.
Right.
So that was what, if you call that radio astronomy, that was one of the things we did.
Did you know about the NRL group that came to Sweden to observe that eclipse?
Yeah, yes, yes.
Did they come and visit your...
Yes, I went with them. I helped them get started at Kalmar, eastern Sweden, John Hagen.
Oh, yes, right.
I knew John Hagen.
And Connie Mayer was along,
yes,
I think.
Yes, I knew Connie Mayer, and I remember the equipment very well. And he's very careful. He's a careful experimenter.
Right.
And yes.
Were there any profitable exchanges of information on microwave work at that time? Since, of course, they were operating at much higher frequencies.
I was the person who gained by looking at the equipment. I went over there several times.
I see.
So Yeah, that's from, so I assisted them in many ways getting started here.
Right.
I think so I did. I don't know what they think.
By
the way, is Connie May, is he retired now?
No, he's still head of the radio astronomy branch at NRL.
When you see him again, give my best regards.
Okay, will do. As you know, I used to work there.
I met him many, many times.
You must have followed with interest when Towns brought his Maser down to NRL and put it on the 50-foot in 58 or so.
Yes, I was there.
You were there?
Yes, I took part in one of the recording sessions on one of the planets with Charlie.
I say, was that just by accident, or?
No. I was interested, and I remember that convinced me, you know, because of the very sort of temporal arrangement he had. I remember the pump crystal thing hanging in there, you know, and a pump power Clyston in a kind of a rope arrangement.
Right.
And Charlie said, just pump it and it works.
Right.
Just give it enough pump power and it's quite stable. And that was about shortly thereafter we started work on doping Ruby. So Charlie, when I saw how easily Charlie could work with his one cavity Maser.
Right.
That really convinced me that the laboratory could and should invest money in develop traveling wave masers.
Because I see.
I never believed in the cavity maser, but because basically it's not a stable arrangement.
You know? Uh-huh.
So, actually, I was spent several days with Charlie Towns and George Main.
Right.
His gratitude. I don't know what he's doing now.
No, I don't. At Columbia.
Yes.
Right.
That planetary experiment was kind of a great inspiration to me.
Did you visit America at that time specifically to be an observer, more or less?
I've been a visiting professor in the States so many times. As a matter of fact, I'm permanent visiting professors at three faculties.
I see.
Penn State. UMass.
So,
from my Harvard days, you know, I had so many associates. I used to visit the States every year.
Oh, I see, okay.
I gave lectures on our traveling wave tube works. I used to visit the Quantum Electronics Conference every year, and so on. So I kept in close touch with low noise receiver developers in the States throughout the 50s.
Okay. Well, okay, let's go back to the 26-meter antenna. Were there any special problems in building it, or did it go pretty smoothly?
It was erected by my own staff.
Yes.
And the Kennedy Company did most of the engineering work. We did the servo systems, of course.
Yes.
And the subreflector, the three-phase subreflector drive, you know, it was designed in such a fashion, because you had no geostationary satellites in those days.
Right.
I had a wobbling kind of arrangement, but the sub-effector is still there. It isn't used anymore, so you get the quarter tracking error, you know, when you track the satellite, and that sort of automatically locks the telescope onto the satellite.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we started tracking deep space probes all with the Würzburg as a test before we tracked Mariner 4 with a 25.6 meter instrument.
Before you tracked which antenna, which satellite?
The Mariner 2.
The Mariner 2.
And then we used a parametric amplifier, the first bit to my knowledge in Scandinavia. It's perhaps one of the first in Europe. We built a parametric amplifier. They used about 960 megahertz at the time.
Right.
And we tracked, NASA had no tracking station in Europe at the time. We tracked Mariner 2.
I see. That was 62, I believe.
Yeah, with the Würzburg that has the meteor Würzburg.
Right.
And then, so one of the first things we did to test the new telescope was to track Mariner 4.
I see.
And had a face lock kind of receiver arrangement. We tracked it all the way to Mars.
And this would be what year now?
I don't remember.
63 or 4, I guess.
Something of that order.
Shortly.
So we. In the final recording phase, we are using a bandwidth of about 1 hertz.
I see.
You know, we got the picture on tape.
Hmm. And now, what was the first radio astronomy you did with the new antenna?
Must have been around. Well, that was with paramps on OH.
Now, the line had just been discovered, right?
Yes, so we verified it.
Right.
And we took even some spectra, not of the quality we have today by any means.
Right.
OH in SAG-B, which was just available for 2 hours.
I think you had a paper or two in Nature about this, didn't you?
No.
No?
No.
I must be getting mixed up.
I guess we reported on it in some kind of early meetings.
Okay.
And then the telegraph administration left the telescope 64.
So then you had
my first good masers, OH masers were ready by 66, 67.
Right.
And I bit the CH maser at the time. We had bit 3 or 4 CH masers, as a matter of fact.
CH masers?
Yeah, because the frequency wasn't known, you know.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we are sending a CH maser to Parks.
Oh, really?
In January.
I see. So now you're saying now that in the period of 67, 68, you were developing CH masers also?
Yes. We built OH and CH masers at about the same time.
I see.
But the first CH maser, the frequency range was too low. And a project, that maser is still lying in the shop in Gotham.
I see.
One of the things I like to do, which I looked at yesterday, I have now more reliable figures on the SI-8 frequency.
I see.
SI-8 lies around 2.9 gigahertz.
Right.
So we may start looking for it within the next year or so.
Right. Well, now going back to the early 60s, you said that you did confirmation of the OH discovery.
Yes.
And you also began longer-term OH programs.
Yes.
What other kinds of programs were done?
We built the formaldehyde maser.
But now this is getting up to 68 now.
Must have been 68, yes.
Right, it was discovered in 68, yeah.
Yeah, we detected it 2 weeks later or something.
I see.
Without really being aware of the American discovery.
I see, is that true? And also, when you got the large antenna, did you expand the staff at Onsala quite a bit?
I did. As
yes.
a matter of fact, the reason, you see, I became interested in excited OH very early. The reason I built the 5 gigahertz maser, which we used to detect formaldehyde, was to detect the 5 gigahertz excited OH transition.
Oh, yes,
that
right.
The maser was built for this double purpose.
Right, I see. That happened in 70 or something like that, I guess.
No, that was much earlier.
The excited OH line?
The excited OH line was 69.
Yeah, okay, 69,
yes,
right.
Yes, we detected the excited OH. Well, the 6 gigahertz excited OH.
Right.
I detected in W75B. I guess in 69.
Okay.
And later on with the same maser detected. Actually, we were the first to detect excited OH 6 gigahertz in absorption W3C.
Right. And you say that this work on OH and CH all goes back to this original Schlossky paper.
Yeah, it's in my mind.
Right, and always in the back of your mind.
When I became interested in spectral line astronomy through Schlossky's paper. Yeah.
Right.
And then 1954... There was a conference in Washington which I didn't attend.
Yes, I know that conference, right.
And I got the print from Charlie Towns, where he had estimated, as far as I recall, the dipole moments of CH and OH, and Schlossky had done the same thing.
That's right.
And I realized that the hydroids, OH and CH, had dipoles strong enough to warrant a search for the molecules.
Right.
But I wasn't aware that OH would mace at the time.
Did you know about Al Barrett's unsuccessful search at NRL?
Yes.
In the mid-50s?
I remember visiting John Hagen, and I guess Barrett had left at that time. Maybe he was around. And I still have that blue cover, that first paper in the blue cover.
The NRL report?
Yeah.
You mean, right.
Yes. Yes, so I was, I knew then that Charlie Townsend's group would have to discover the frequency.
Yeah, right.
To measure the frequencies. As far as I recall, Alan Barrett did not use. They didn't know the frequency well enough.
Yes, that's correct. He was searching over a very wide band.
Yes. Yes. So I know when Charlie Townsend determined the frequencies of the two main lines, you know, I knew that the time was ripe to look for OH with traveling wave mason.
Something just occurred to me. It's perhaps just a coincidence, but it's interesting that both you and Towns worked so much with masers in the laboratory and also got involved with them in the sky, but I think it's just an accident, actually.
Yes, it is an accident in both cases, I believe.
Well, but I mean, it's an accident. It's not because of your interest in masers in the laboratory that that you ended up studying masers in the sky. There's really no connection.
No, it's so that, you see, that that to build a maser in the laboratory is one thing, you know. But to build a maser that could be used in a telescope, a traveling wave maser that could be stable enough, you know, mechanically stable enough.
Yes.
I got money for the Science Foundation. I had convinced them that it was worth the money to build maser specially, develop maser specially for this telescope.
When you were working on masers in the lab in the late 50s, were you quite convinced that that they could work on the telescope?
I was all the time.
But
not cavity masers, you know. I built ruby cavity masers, you know. I have small ruby blocks like this lump of sugar, you know.
Yes.
Which were silver coated, and I had small waveguide holes in it, you know.
Right.
But you know, it's not a stable device, you know. When you increase the gain, you decrease the bandwidth.
Right, right.
So I was convinced that we had to build a ruby maser. Later on, I was convinced that the specific gain in ruby so low that you end up with a very long maser structure. So then we very early, as you may know, turned to rutile.
Right.
You know, chromium and iron dope, rutile, and our present, we are within a few weeks going to test a maser that operates from 30 to 34 gigahertz on the new telescope. Well, that's
good. I see.
That has iron dope rutile.
But
so we left the ruby field very early.
Right. What were the special things that you had to do to adapt a lab maser to be a radiometer on the telescope?
Well, to develop good cryostats and reliable couplings and so on that could, that really would be reliable.
Yeah.
And that took several years. Well, you know, you have to be, if you're familiar with cryogenics, you know, and you have coupling loops and whatnot, you see. And we had to spend, that's difficult to make properly, and the feed system, you know.
Basically because the whole thing is moving around to different orientations.
You are tilting the maser, you know, because the maser is always tilting to a certain extent, you know.
Right, right.
And then, you see, we had to develop server systems that will keep the helium pressure, the helium temperature constant, you know, so you could operate with constant gain. You see, in the laboratory, you don't care about it, you know.
Right.
As helium boils off, you know, or the temperature changes, you measure the gain as a function of temperature, but when you use a maser in a telescope, you must run with constant helium bath temperatures.
Right, right.
So there are so many difficult things, you know, which we have mastered a long time ago. You know?
Things are much more critical, yeah.
But I was convinced all the time.
Well, let me ask a couple more general questions about during the 50s. For instance, you went to the Jodrell Bank meeting in 55, I believe. Do you have any specific memories of that meeting as to any impressions that you recall?
Well, the most interesting talks were given by Burbidge and wife.
By Burbidge and who?
By Geoffrey Burbidge and his wife.
Oh, and his wife, yes.
Yeah, that's sort of one of my great memories.
And this was on what? The energetics of radio sources?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Nuclear synthesis.
Right.
As far as I recall. But then when I saw, this is not to criticize Jodrell Bank, but when I saw their electronics equipment.
Yes.
Then I became convinced because it was at that time a high noise system.
Right, right.
That convinced me. That's interesting because it convinced me that with the masers we will be able to compete for the big Jodrell Bank dishes.
Now, of course, they didn't have the dish quite. It was building then, wasn't it?
It was almost finished, at least mechanically.
Yeah, it took another.
Mechanically, because they were testing the service systems that we were there.
Yeah, I think it took another 2 years before they got on the air, actually.
But I saw the receivers in the electronics shop.
Right, right.
Then I was convinced because. You know,
that you could compete, right?
With masers, yes. Yeah, I was convinced. But after all, with limited resources at the time, you know, it took us several years to build reliable masers.
Right.
It's an enormous step from from having running a traveling wave measure in the laboratory, running one in the telescope. You know.
Right, indeed.
And it, now we have Christ, that's that whole helium about a week, you know. All that took time to develop.
If someone had asked you in the mid-50s, you know, what do you do, how would you describe yourself? What is your profession?
My profession?
Yes, in the mid-50s.
Well, I am professor of theoretical electron physics.
Is that what you would have said? Or would you have said that you are an electrical engineer or a radio physicist? Or?
Well, no, physicist. Because, you see, at Harvard I studied quantum physics, solid-state physics, Van Vleck, of course, as you know.
Yeah.
That's another interesting story, because it was through Van Vleck's work on lambda doubling.
Yes.
That I became interested, you know. You see, that's another approach. I've seen the dipole moments. Maybe it was in Sklosky's paper, estimated frequencies.
That's right.
OH and CH. But then I became, it immediately struck me. That was the theory that lambda doublet was done by Van Vleck.
That's right.
So I heard about the lambda doublet.
Even in the late 30s now, you're saying?
Yes, in the late 30s, that's correct. But I didn't attach any significance to it at that time.
Right, right. What about your relationships with optical astronomers, in Sweden especially, but also in other places? Have you been in contact with them, or has it been more or less a separate development of radio astronomy?
I was in contact especially with the late Professor Lindblad.
With Lindblad?
Professor Lindblad, the one who worked in galactic structure.
Right.
Well, he, within the limited means that he could sort of place at our disposal through the Science Foundation, he supported this, he did everything he could to support
I see.
Work.
So, okay, he was the chief astronomer in Sweden, was he not?
He was at the time.
So you had his support, but you did not have the support of many of the other astronomers, I gather.
Well, I wouldn't say so. I don't think I would be that specific. They were not familiar with the field, you know.
You're right.
So,
but they were not...
But Lindblad never thought that we could really discover OH.
I see.
No, that was he thought OH would be dissociated. You know?
Yeah. Was he mainly interested from what you might learn from the hydrogen line?
Yes. And he was, I would say, put it this way, that he was slightly unhappy when I didn't, that we did not continue work on the H line with our first maser.
Right.
Our first maser, as I told you, was a hydrogen line maser.
And
so we switched, and I said to him, the only field where we can compete is with molecular lines, OH and CH, I remember it. He said, I'm going to stop working on the hydrogen line. Yes, I said.
Yeah. And this
so
would...
I switched my man to OH, and one of the first I switched was a man by the name Binberg, who works at Bonn.
Oh, yes, I know Anders well, yes.
He's been working with OH ever since, and it took some persuasion. I had to persuade him.
Right.
So change from hydrogen line work to OH, and I don't think he ever regretted that I persuaded him to change to OH.
Right, right.
But I've been, through the years, I've been in touch with many astronomers. Menzel at Harvard, I heard, listened to his lectures, and we have been in touch for many, many years.
Menzel?
Yeah.
Yes, right.
Donald Menzel.
Well, that pretty well covers what I wanted to cover. Did you have any other points? Going up through the early 60s only now.
Not that I can remember, no.
I think we've done it pretty thoroughly. Well, thank you.
That ends the interview with Olaf E.H. Rydbeck over the phone from Groningen to Onsala on 15 September 78.